For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, before we get started on our study, I just thought I'd share a little news with you. We don't do that often enough around here. CNN.com put out an article this week, and it's been reported in numerous news outlets. And I'll just read a little brief piece of it. It says, "Goodbye, universe. You came with the biggest bang ever, and now you're on your way out with a drooping fizzle." The conclusion of a new astronomical study pulls no punches on this. The universe is slowly dying, it reads. Astronomers who have believed as much for years, but now the new findings establish the cosmos' decline with unprecedented precision. An international team of some 100 scientists used data from the world's most powerful telescopes based on land and in space to study energy coming from more than 200,000 galaxies in a large sliver of the observable universe. Based on these observations, they have confirmed that the cosmos is radiating only half as much energy as it did 2 billion years ago. The astronomers published their study Monday on the website of the European Southern Observatory. The team checked the energy across a broad spectrum of light waves and other electromagnetic radiation, and says that it is fading through all wavelengths from ultraviolet to infrared. Analysis across many wavelengths show the universe's electromagnetic energy output is dropping. At the ripe old age of 13.8 billion years, the universe has arrived at its sunset years. The universe has basically sat down on the sofa, pulled up a blanket, and is about to nod off for an eternal doze, said astronomer Simon Driver, who led the team. So that's kind of funny in a way. Why am I talking about that? It has absolutely nothing to do with John chapter 14. But here's the significant thing, and the reason I bring this to your attention. For years, it has been suggested by many astronomers, we know that the universe began at a point in time in the so-called Big Bang. But it has been suggested and really hoped for by many astronomers that the process of the Big Bang and the expansion that came out of that would one day come to a screeching halt, and that the gravitational pull of the universe would suck the whole thing right back together again into the opposite of a Big Bang, a big contraction, and causing a sort of a yo-yo effect, an oscillation that would go on forever. And what this research shows is that that is not going to happen. And why does that matter to us? Because it provides one of the most compelling forensic scientific arguments that there could possibly be, that the universe is finite and that it required something outside of itself to explain its existence. In other words, it's one of the most powerful scientific arguments for the existence of God to date. And so I just thought I would share that with you. I think it's really important, and as we put together the framework of our faith, which includes not just the things that we're convinced of from the scriptures and so forth, but the things also that we arrive at through the exercise of our mind and our observations of the universe as we know it, that really to love God with our whole being and our mind means that we are, you know, informed on these things, and that we stand with real certainty. It's not a wishful thinking. That's not what Christian faith is. It's rooted in reality as we can best understand it and describe it. So I just pass that on to you for your encouragement. I felt very encouraged in reading that this week. Just felt, once again, convinced that the way that the Bible describes things is the way things truly are. Anyway, now for something completely different. We're going to talk about parables at a dinner party. This is Luke chapter 14, verses 7 to 14. The context is that Jesus has been invited to dinner by a Pharisee, by a member of the Jewish religious elite. And the reasons for the invitation given in verse 1 and following is basically they're looking for things that Jesus might do that would offend them. But Jesus uses the opportunity for something different. And it says in verse 7 that Jesus began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out the places of honor at the table, saying to them, when you're invited to someone by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for someone more distinguished than you may have been invited, and when he who is invited both will come by and say to you, give your place to this man, and then, he says, in disgrace you will proceed to the last place. But when you are invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. So there it is, the dinner party, the first parable. A little bit just about the context. To be invited to someone's home in the ancient world was, you know, a lot more important than the casual dinner invitations that we extend to people today. This is an era of time, there were no stereos, no movies, no internet, really very few books even. And the main thing that people would do to come together is they would relate. Yeah. They would talk to each other over the most valuable thing that they could present, which is, namely, a meal. And so hospitality in the ancient Near Eastern world, as it is today in some places in the world, is really a huge deal. And to be invited to a dinner party is an honor. And to go to the dinner party honors the person that you has been invited you. And so it's like it's a huge deal. These things were so important, in fact, that it was selective. Only certain people would be invited. And even where you sat around the table mattered a great deal. So there would be the place at the head of the table, and that would be for the host. And the host then would arrange seating around the floor where people would sit, and because it matters who you are and where do you fit in the pecking order and so forth. So that's what's going on in this context. And in that context, Jesus is beginning to realize something is strange, something going on, and which is that he began to realize that people were not really waiting to be assigned the seats that were accorded to them based upon their honor, but they were just grabbing the best seats, you know, the stuff that's right by the meat, you know, stuff like that. And so there's this awkward thing, and it's made even more awkward by the fact that in these ancient acts of hospitality, those who are not invited would often line up outside the house. They would try to peer in the window. They want to know who is there and where are they sitting. And if there's a guest of honor, which in this case there was, Jesus was there, what does the guest of honor have to say? This is a huge thing. And so Jesus is noticing the fact that these people are using this opportunity, this high-profile moment, as a way to kind of, you know, elevate their status in the community. And so for that reason, he's like, he tells his parable. He doesn't tell directly. He doesn't say, hey, Ned, who said you could sit there? Go back to the back where you belong. It was more like, Ned, I got a story to tell you about a guy, you know, and that's what he's doing here. And so it's like, you know, it's a pretty thinly veiled rebuke is what it is. There's a key principle, though, that's involved in this, and this principle, we'll find, works its way out through the breadth of this narrative and the other parable that is to follow, and which is that everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. And this, as it turns out, is an extremely important principle that Jesus uses repeatedly in the gospel. It's a part of this broader, what we call the reversal theme in Jesus' teaching. Who is the greatest among you? The servant of all, right? He who is first shall be last, and the last shall be first. And all of these reversals that are paradoxical in nature, blessed, Jesus says, are the poor. Now there's a reversal for you. And so to understand, really at the heart of Jesus' teaching is that what we expect to be the case and how we think about the way things ought to be in human terms, is just not at all what God is interested in. And compounding that with the idea that in this section, especially of the Gospel of Luke, much of what Jesus is doing and what he is teaching is there to instruct his disciples. These are messages for them to learn because the day is coming when Jesus will no longer be on the scene. And it's like, well, how do we conduct ourselves from here? What really matters? And they will go back to these lessons that Jesus taught in their presence. The disciples really need to understand this. This is not just some rude people at a dinner party. If you kind of fast forward just a few months from this event, you've got two of Jesus' closest disciples sending their mother to Jesus, saying, "Hey, Jesus, when you arrive in your kingdom, don't forget to put my sons, one on your right side and the other on your left." To which the rest of the disciples were like, "Oh, man, I can't believe the presumption, and that you got there before me." And so this is an important lesson. It's an important lesson that's applied in a broad way, but certainly relevant to Jesus' disciples. Jesus really embodies the principle that he's identifying here. All of the things that Jesus teaches, these pithy one-liners that we remember and that really capture the essence of Jesus' teaching, really apply first and most primarily to Jesus himself. So what about Jesus in that place of humility? Yes. How about what Paul says in Philippians chapter 2? He said, although he existed in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, being made in human likeness, being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So when we talk about this key principle of those who humble themselves will be exalted and those who exalt themselves will be humbled, how much more graphic could it be than the God of the universe? To go back to our news brief, it is relevant. The author of the Big Bang, the power so great that he spoke the world into existence, that all things exist simply because he chose them to exist. That's an exalted state. And he humbled himself. He subjected himself to the very creation that he made. And not just subjected himself to the physical universe, but yielded himself to the will of rebellious creation. Obedient, it says, to the point of death, even death on the cross. That's humility. That's Jesus Christ. This is the succinct elevator speech of God to us. What is God like? Boom, he's like that. That's who God is. That's what God is like. And so when we talk about this important principle of discipleship, this idea of humility, it is rooted in the person of God. He's not asking us to do anything that he has not himself done first. And so following Christ means cultivating this very humility that he speaks of and which he demonstrated himself. Really think that the text in Philippians says earlier, he says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourself. So that's what it is. Jesus states the principle, embodies the principle, and then calls us to the principle. Humility. The easiest lesson of all to learn. I like the way Andrew Murray puts it in his book, appropriately titled Humility. He says, humility is the only soil in which the graces root. In other words, the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. The kind of things that define what Christian maturity is like, he said, Murray's point is, those things occur, they grow in the soil of the heart that has been shaped by humility. And he says the lack of humility is sufficient explanation of every defect and failure. Ugh. Humility is not so much a virtue along with others. It is the root of all because it takes the right attitude before God. And so I just think, you know, we've talked about humility before because Jesus has brought it up already in his teaching and specifically in his denunciations of the religious. But now, really, his sights are set more to his disciples. And so I think it's really valuable for us at this point in the parable just to reflect for a second. What does that mean concretely, practically? How do you take the lower seat? That's where that expression, you've heard the expression, taking the lower seat. It comes from this parable right here. What does it mean to have this kind of humility, which is so absolutely essential to everything that matters to us in the Christian life? Well, I thought about this a little bit. It seems to me that at the core is a heart that initiates serving as opposed to waiting to be served. It's really very important that we understand that the prideful heart of man says, me first. The prideful heart of man says it's all about my agenda. It's about what I want. It's about what reflects well on me. And so I may be inclined to do things that are noteworthy, but why am I doing these things? Well, because they're noteworthy. That's why, because it draws attention to moi. And pride is just absolutely at the heart of what is wrong with humanity. It's what's wrong with us. And so to develop humility in a practical sense, is to initiate serving rather than waiting to be served. It is putting the needs and the interests of others above self, just like Paul said in Philippians 2. It's a great practical demonstration of this thing that your entire spiritual life will be more or less defined by. How do we do that? What does that mean? Well, here would be one critical distinction. Being self-absorbed, being preoccupied with my feelings versus a gracious and compassionate interest in others. The prideful person is deeply self-aware of how they feel and especially of how the things that other people do affect them. Right? I'm right about that. Okay? I am an expert in this field. And I'm telling you this is the way it is. Acutely sensitive to, am I being respected? Am I being trusted? Am I being admired or cared about or advanced or whatever it is your ego thinks that it needs? That's what I mean by self-absorbed preoccupation with my feelings. And this, for many of us, is just a desperate battle that we fight. Sometimes we don't even understand that we're in that fight until we realize just how incredibly alienated we are from people and how we walk around with this funky depression that we can't really understand. Where did that come from and what's that about? Or a kind of anxiety that dogs us and says, you know, everything that I try is just never quite good enough and it doesn't feel fulfilling to me and I'm unsatisfied. And why is that? Because we're trying to fill the ego needs generated by pride that we absolutely cannot and will not ever fill. And instead, a person who is understanding humility is one who takes that eyes off of self, and C.S. Lewis said it so profoundly so many years ago, that he says that what God calls us to is not to think less of ourselves, as though somehow other people matter more than we, but instead, he says, to think about ourself less. That. And to be gracious and compassionate in our interest with other people is the pathway to finding true humility. You say, I don't understand how humility works. I can't make myself humble. You sure can't. That's exactly right. But what you can do is you can begin doing those things that humility looks like, trusting that God will begin to reshape your heart. Because in being compassionate and putting that focus on other people and having the heart of God for them, the forgiving and merciful heart of God for other people, it really then begins to burble to the surface what's really wrong with you to begin with. Those things that in your pride that say no to being in a, to relating to people in a Christ-like way. And then we can turn from those things. We can turn those over to Christ. And in that way, become increasingly humble people. The proudful person is ever aware of their needs and their disappointments. And what you got's never enough. And the way people serve you is, well, it's okay, but it really is, no, it's not really that great after all. And so we are always kind of grading people on that C minus. Come on, you can do better. Serve me better than that. Ever aware of needs and living in that place of disappointment. That's what the prideful heart is about. Versus the humble heart of gratitude for God's generosity. Because what, at the end of the day, do you merit from God? A big fat zilch. And what do you really merit? And what do people really owe you? A big fat zilch. Do you know that? Are you aware of this fact? Are you aware of this fact? Come on, man. Think about it. We all go through life with this world of expectation, only to be shattered by the pathetic attempts of people around us to really meet those expectations. Well, I'm overly dramatizing the fact that we just are that way. And that the measure of humility is the person who just, in a conscious and deliberate way, is able to come before God and before others to say, you don't owe me anything. If anything, I'm in your debt. And I am so thankful for you. And if there's any way that I can serve you, count on me. That's what the humble does. Man, if we could live this way, this would turn around in a radical way our marriages that are struggling right now. It was said to me years ago, I believe it's true, that all of us are no more than a couple, three really good decisions to come into a place of real victory in those really important areas of our life, with our children, with our spouses, with our close friends, and so forth. People at work. Just a few decisions away from being humble in the way that we're describing here. That heals relationships. And conversely, we're also no more than a couple, three really bad decisions from destroying them. So everything's kind of at stake here. It's really an important lesson to learn, humility. And that's why Jesus brings it out so many times. But let's read on, because it says in verse 12, Jesus also went on to say, to the one who invited him. So now his attention is focused on the host. When you have a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or brothers or relatives or your rich neighbors. Otherwise, they may also invite you in return, and that will be your repayment. In other words, if what you're really looking for is just loving people who love you back, that's really not the wealth that God wants to give us from being generous. He wants a lot more. When you give a reception, verse 13, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed since they do not have the means to repay you. And so here we go. You will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. So that's the focus. Not who can pay me back for the things that I do. And then we have this cushy kind of quid pro quo based relationships where we love people who love us and who are like us, and at the exclusion, of course, of everybody else. So to the host, the question is raised, what is the purpose of hospitality? And Jesus is just directly challenging the idea that hospitality is there to have a little in club of people who are like you and who can do the same thing for you. What is the purpose of hospitality? I love the term. What does hospitality mean? philoxeneo, the love of xenoids, the love of strangers. That's literally what hospitality means. The love of strangers. Hospitality doesn't mean loving those who love you. I mean, it's sort of involved with that, but if you define it by its furthest reach and its most essential component, hospitality means loving people who can never pay you back. It's simply an act of generosity, the kind of generosity that we give to others because God has been so generous with us. I love to think about this. The book that that Linda and I read very early on in our marriage, and which we have shamelessly hoisted upon everyone whose marriage we're invited to, wedding we're invited to, is What is a Family? By Frances Eva Schaefer. The most rambling book ever written. But she makes this point that we have never forgotten, and which is a kind of a game changer for us. What is the purpose of a family? It is to show forth the existence of God. That's what. That's the purpose of a family. To reflect the goodness and the grace and the reality of God. And so to show hospitality is to extend grace. It's to have that household. Here's a vision for us as we are at that place in life where we're getting paired up. We're beginning to hatch our chicklets and all this kind of stuff. That what is the thing? What's the reason? What's the purpose for all of this? It's that. To show forth the existence of God. My children, my family, my household is there for the purpose of the love relationship that we enjoy with God and enjoy together is then an open to the xenoi, the stranger, the alien, the anybody who might be in need. And just to have the pleasure of giving to others what God has given to us is both deeply satisfying, deeply fulfilling, and shows forth the existence of God. That's a vision for your home, for your family. And that's what he's describing right here. What is the purpose of hospitality? That's the purpose. Here's another purpose for hospitality. Worship. What is worship? We get in our cultural framework, Christendom. We think that it's something that you do on a Sunday morning that involves singing songs that are not cool anymore, but which because of generations past, you're consigned to sing at various points. I think often that's the case. Some people are attracted to that, most people are not. Fewer and fewer are. And therefore, you know, so now I've done my thing, I've worshiped God. But that's not the way Jesus put it. And so how did he put it in a way that relates to this? Matthew 25, I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer, well, when did we see you naked, hungry, thirsty, in prison, and so forth? And the king will answer, truly, I say to you that to the extent that you did it to one of these, my brothers, even to the least of them, you did it to me, to me, to me. That's worship. To give what you have to him, to me, he says. How do we do that? Well, in a very profound way, it is by taking his heart into those who are at the periphery of blessing in our culture, to those who are in the greatest place of need. What hypocrisy it is to do the kind of a ceremony. And then to walk away to, it's my house, it's my stuff, it's my life. Just how utterly hypocritical that is. And what Jesus is calling to is something way deeper. And hospitality, as it's described in Scripture, is a microcosm of this much bigger pattern of living. That's what worship is. Present your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service of worship. That's what Paul says in Romans 12:1. That's what we're talking about here. To be about the things that our Lord is concerned about is to serve Him. He then goes on, verse 15, when one of those who were reclining at the table with Jesus heard what Jesus was saying, he stands up. Blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God. In other words, let's change the subject quickly. To which Jesus says, not so fast. A man was giving a big dinner. Here's our second parable. And he invited many. And at the dinner hour, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, I have bought a piece of land and I need to go out and look at it. You bought it sight unseen? Please consider me excused. Verse 19, another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm going to try them out. Test drive them around the plot or something. Please consider me excused. I had this image of oxen races, you know, like Ben-Hur in somebody's backyard. It's just the craziest thing. Another said, well, I've married a wife. Good to know. And for that reason, I cannot come. Really? As though somehow this is like a stag party or something. The slave returned and he reported this to the master. Then the head of the household became angry and he said to his slave, go out at once into the streets and lanes of the city and bring in that same list that we just looked at a minute ago. The poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. And the slave said, Master, what you commanded has been done, and still there is more room. And the master said to the slave, go out into the highways and along the hedges and compel them to come in so that my house may be filled. And now we're bringing the whole thing home. This brings it all together. I tell you, none of those men who were invited shall taste of my dinner. There's a reversal for you right there. Those who were invited are not going to taste of my dinner. And who will? The super unlikely. That's who. The humble. So let's just talk about this in terms of very practical application. What does the parable say to us? First, it says that God is throwing a party. Many are invited. Come, he says, everything is now ready. The universe, here's the thing. The universe in its physical form is going to die, just like I read at the outset of this thing. See, it does relate. It's going to run out of gas. It's going to be this cold thing where not even a molecule moves. And while that's going on, God's got something else going on. Which is a party. A party. The central image given to us in the book of Revelation as it talks about the end of the history is a party. Revelation 19, verse 9, where it is the wedding feast of the Lamb and we're all invited. And wow, what a feast that will be as Christ, our Lord, our Savior, becomes permanently wedded to us in the most intimate fellowship, described in terms of the ancient festival, the feast, the abundance, the warmth, the connection, the welcome, the acceptance, all the things that describe true relational fulfillment and connection. That is the end to which we who have been invited are heading. I think that's pretty sweet. That's a party. Not a bunch of angels strumming their harps on clouds. I wonder where that image came from. It's a party, free-flowing food, wine, all of the best. That's where it's heading. God is throwing a party. My friends, you're invited. We're all invited. The way it ends is in a party, not in a big freeze. Come on in, out of the cold. There's a place for you around the table. What does it mean? How do I get in on this? What do I do? The invitation's there. We're looking now for a response of faith. Faith is, and the response of faith is really the ironic key to this parable. Again, it's that reversal theme. The first will be last, the last will be first. The humble is exalted, the exalted is humbled. That's the ironic thing. This whole deal is really about how am I going to respond to God. Here's a response to consider. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and I'll dine with him and he with me. That's the offer of Jesus Christ. It's Jesus himself speaking right here. Knocking on your door. I got a dinner for you. I want you to dine with me. I want you to have this intimate, personal contact with me. I want you to invite me into your life so that we can share this intimate bond together. That's what's on the table. Christianity is not about trying to do better, going through the right kind of religious motions, whatever you may envision Christianity to be. It's not about joining Xenos Christian Fellowship or a home church or whatever you may be thinking. What Christianity is at the heart is described right here. It is that moment in time when we hear Christ knocking. Who hears Christ knocking? What attunes our ear to the knocking of Christ? Well, it shouldn't strike us as being too far out there that it would be the poor, the lame, the blind. Yeah? See the point? It's people who recognize their poverty and who, for whom the offer of something real from God, they hear that, it lands them. But it's not enough to say, that's awesome. And it's not enough to say, oh, I believe that. No, there's an action involved. And what is that action? Open the door. It's a decision that we make before God. We just come before Him. I hear you knocking. I understand that you have provided for me a way to be reconciled with you, even acknowledging, as I must, my mountain of guilt before you. And I understand that that way comes through what Jesus did on the cross for me. And I hear, at this point, God, I just want to tell you, I want in on that. I want to receive what He's done for me. That is the whole picture. That's your seat at the table right there. As many as received Him, to them He gave the right to become children of God. John 1, verse 12. Some of us tonight have thought about Christianity. We've been sniffing around the edges of the Christian message. We've been asking our questions, and we're getting some response to those questions. And we're hearing that still small voice nudging us, saying, you know what, this is really true. Inwardly, we have this awareness that this is the case, and now is the time, in the quiet of your own hearts before God, just to open that door and say, come in. I want that. I want to be a part of that dinner. Well, yeah. Here's the question. What's keeping you away from the table? They all alike began making excuses. And that's really such a drag, isn't it? Yeah, God, you know, that's all cool and stuff, but I just got married. And so I don't know how that really fits into my agenda right now, because I'm married. I got this new thing and I'm excited about it. I bought some land. I'm now landed. And that's really occupying my time, and that's so very important to me, certainly way more important than the God of the universe. And then there's those ox. I mean, really. You can't imagine the joy of being dragged around a field by ox. Man, our culture is so distracted. And why? Because we just got all these things going on, and we're distracted, and we're distracted, and we're distracted. And then, you know, often, the reality is it's just too late. That's the reality of it. And this passage is a warning to a culture like ours that is so deeply distracted by all of the things that we have that compete for our attention. We can't even have that reflective moment where we're looking inward, where we're hearing the knock of Christ. Because why? Because that thing in my hand is just, you know, I'm pushing buttons and these things are happening and I become a zombie to distraction, to my job, to all these things that we look to, things that are transitory, things that will end, and things that ultimately do not satisfy. The real condition of man, Jesus says in Revelation 3:17, because you say, I'm rich, and I have become wealthy, and I have need of nothing, that's our culture, right? That's our culture. We're rich. We're comfortable. We like it that way. We're in need of nothing. That's the ideal. Rely on no one but myself. Create a world that insulates me from the troubles of the world around me so that I can just enjoy myself. And Jesus says, you do not know that you're wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. You know, there's such a focus in our culture to be happy and to find the pathway to happiness, which is, you know, the job security and all the things that we're keeping these very same people away from the invitation to the dinner that Jesus is offering. But we know that we're unsatisfied in the pursuit of those things. That we know that there is a lurking emptiness within, and that we try to push it down through our various forms of advancements or purchases or new relationships or whatever those things might be. And they're not scratching that itch. That's just the reality of it. And why is that? Because none of those things were ever designed to fulfill our most basic need. We are spiritual beings. Yes, we live in a physical world, but we are spiritual beings. And we will never find the fulfillment that we seek until that deep spiritual need is met. And how is it met? Only by being reconciled to our Creator and to have His spiritual presence in our lives, completing God's design for us to be in relationship to Him. That's the truth, and we sense that through the kind of despair that we experience when we allow ourselves to think it. And my friends, so many of you are working and living in communities and people are just marching along, and it just seems like everything is great. What's the relevance of what I believe to what I see out there? Oh, man, everything, that's what. Everything, that's what. If we're prepared to cut through the superficialities in the lives of people that God has brought into our presence through prayer, through compassionate moving towards them, through meeting real needs, through sharing our lives, through putting the message of Christ out on the table, and we are prepared to stay in that place, we will begin to see scales falling. We'll begin to see that those who have built these elaborate, wealthy walls around themselves and who are rotting inside but can't let anyone know, no one can afford to be that vulnerable because there's no answer to this. And once that answer becomes through you, just a little bit more plausible, those defenses then come down just a bit. And the more plausible, the further those walls come down. And now we have real conversation because at the end of the day, everyone's invited to the party, and the people who are not there yet know it. They know it. And we're helping them to come to that point where they can hear the knock of Christ in their life. This is how we should be praying. This should be occupying center stage in our life as Christians. It's to the humble Jesus turns his attention. The well-off seem not to be quite so interested. The poor, the cripple, the blind, and the lame. And this then brings us to our final point. That the concern of Christ and the heart of God is really to move toward those places of real need when they're evident. The ministry of the kingdom surrounds God's heart for the poor, for the crippled, for the blind, for the lame, for the sinner, for the outsider. Not because they are more meriting, I suppose, of the dinner party that God's going to throw, but it's because they recognize they're in a place where they hear that knock. That's the point of this parable. The priorities for God's people in an age of overwhelming contentment, which is what our age is, needs to be moving in a broader lens to those places, the sojourner among us, those who are troubled. Jesus says, those who are in prison, you visit them. It's like visiting me. The poor, the broken. Now, I want to just suggest that it is God's intent that we continue a robust, active, effective, prayer-drenched love of our peers, the people that God has brought in our life, our neighbors, our work associates, our broader family, things like that. That doesn't go away. That is uniquely our calling. It's why God put us in space and time the way he did. While at the same time recognizing that many of those who are close in are content. And that it's going to take time to move toward people who are the Brahmins of this culture, who have everything, who have their ego at stake. It's going to take a while for the guards to lower and for real, genuine spiritual communication to take place. I realize that that's true. What do we do during the meantime? The same thing that the master did. What is that? Well, then broaden the invitation base. Go to the places where my heart is, which is among the poor, the troubled, the broken, the sojourner. We can do that, and we must do that here, among the 25 home churches that make up our Sunday night fellowship. We need to broaden our lens. There are all manner of demographic transitions taking place that make the prospect of loving those who are most like us increasingly ineffective. In 4.5 years, for instance, white children will be the largest minority in America, according to the last census. Our culture is changing demographically, racially, culturally. The world has been brought to us. Praise God for that. Thank God for that. And there are opportunities now to touch the world that have never been available to us until this time. The sojourner among us, by way of international students, by way of refugees, by way of all manner of people who have come here and migrated for economic reasons. Those are God's people. God is inviting them to the table, and He's inviting them through you and me. The broken. People who are in physical dire straits, whose lives are broken in a variety of ways. Increasingly, the majority of children born in America are born in single-parent households. How about widening our scope of concern to meet that need? The troubled, youth, people in prison, these kinds of things. There is an opportunity there. The poor, to develop strategic, kingdom-advancing ministry among these populations is no longer an option for us. We have got to do that. And many of our groups are doing exactly that and are thriving. And I want to just plea with you that now is the time, especially some of our older groups, to be thinking much more strategically about what it is that we are doing, and are we advancing the gospel tangibly and practically through those very populations that maybe didn't get that first invitation, and but which are at close to the heart of God, and which God is pleading with us, extend that invitation through.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.